About Von Paul.
Yeah, well,
more current stuff.
Well,
still.
The bombings last week in Vientiane, you know, killed several people out back in the morning market. There was a bomb put on the bus. And I know nothing about the background of what's gone on, business conflicts or political conflicts. Is it the anti-communist resistance or what? But there was some stuff on email about it from the Thai Lao Cambodia Veterans Group I belong to, and people were asking about it. And I went back and I said, hey, you know, the way it's at least recently being done, whoever's doing this, terrorism. Uh-huh. You know, that's not resistance type stuff. You know, totally different, animal.
Yeah.
And if you're anti-war or pro-war, well, I was pro-war during all the war years.
Uh-huh.
So I guess that's just my background.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and a supporter of it. And, you know, sometimes mistakenly so, you know, believed in the leadership.
What's that?
Believed in the U.S. leadership, the government.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, mistakenly or not, you know, here we are 25 years after, you know, Vietnam, Cambodia went down the tubes, and Laos sort of more gracefully went down the tubes, you know, Laos style, but Thailand is still, you know, running free. So,
uh-huh.
And the economy, other than a few minor glitches here, is still kind of booming. So, you know, did... you know, the 10-year pause in communist expansion in Indochina, you know, helped Thailand survive. You know, it might well have.
Yeah, we could go down the speculation road forever.
Yeah.
we'd be having beers into next morning.
Right. a lot of people ask me about, you know, on the email especially, you know, what do I think about this, think about that, and I say, hey, I just basically stay out of it.
I just live here.
That's right. I don't have enough background knowledge of what's going on either side of the river to speak authoritatively on, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, what's happening. So.
Yeah. Let me, pause at least and maybe stop, because I have to...
I think we can get this together. We've had both of us have had our
coffee,
little break.
Yeah.
Coffee and other things down in the washroom. And we were just getting back to questions of security. And I thought this was at least funny.
Yeah.
That you mentioned that you slept with your boots on but not laced.
Yeah. Well,
and then why?
Yeah, it was, you know, this is in fall of 67. There was kind of a debate going on with amongst some of the IBS, and, you know, you say the field people too. You know, if the shit hits the fan at night, and you end up having to run, do you grab your radio first, your ground air radio, so you can talk to the Air America, Continental Airlines people as they're flying over in the morning, or do you grab your boots? You know, because you're going to have to walk. And, you know, if you grab your boots and walk out and miss the radio, you might have to walk 10 miles or 20 miles. And it's uncomfortable, and it's up and down the hills, and you might get picked up, you know, unless you're in the real brush and they can't see you. And
mm-hmm,
you don't have a match, you can't light a fire. Or should you grab your radio and, you know, go out walking, you know, and cut your feet up and everything, 5 miles, 10 miles, but, you know, first thing in the morning, be able to call somebody down. Maybe you only have to walk 100 yards and hide in the bush. But,
mm-hmm.
So I often at Singalom, you know, and nothing ever happened while I was at Singalom, or not much, but I slept with my boots on, but not laced, so there's no decision to make if something happened. Just up, grab your radio and your harness, and split.
And worry about the laces later.
Right.
Just don't step on the laces. Right. Because then you'll fall on your radio and break it, and then where the hell will you be?
Yeah. I still have that radio here.
You know, oh, do you really? You kept your radio?
Well, when we left Laos, you know, I wasn't going to leave it to the Patet Lao. You know, they took over everything, so...
But when you were in IVS, that's when you were given the radio.
Well, it was a USAID radio. When you were in the field, you had, you know, the ground air radio.
Right.
And actually, I think the only time I ever went out without a radio, and I don't know if Galen Berry would remember this or not, I was when I first got to Hong Sa in September 66, and
uh-huh,
probably October 66, we got a call from Hafner that Galen was coming up, going to pick me up, and we were flying over to Singalom for a day or two, and fix a M37 truck, a little small three-quarter ton truck, get it repaired so they could fly it out. They wanted the truck someplace else. So John Van Tyne and I at Hong Sa, we only had one radio. And if I remember right, Galen didn't bring one with him, so we went over to Singalom without a radio.
Uh-huh.
And we were supposed to, you know, C-123 was supposed to...
So the three of you?
No, Van Tyne stayed in
He stayed, so he kept
Hong
the radio.
He kept the radio. Galen and I went over to Tsinghua.
Okay.
And we were supposed to be picked up, you know, in 2 days. The 123 come in to pick up the
So if anything had happened in those 2 days, you would have only been with your boots.
Right. And it was about day four or day five, you know.
Nobody showed up.
Nobody showed up. And we hear a porter, you know, flying overhead. And he was landing, so we go screaming down to the runway. And, you know, hey, what are you guys doing here? Didn't know anybody was here. So, well, we're waiting for 123. You know, glad to see you. What's going on? I said, oh, it's a coup d'etat in Vientiane. It was the, Talma's Lao Air Force general. His first coup d'etat, and everything got kind of confused. And I guess they all kind of forgot about us.
Well, easily forgettable compared to what was going on locally.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, after that, you know, my radio was my companion.
Yeah. You had to call in every day?
Well, we had
was that the situation?
No, twice a day. We had...
twice a day.
Yeah,
okay.
Morning and evening radio checks. We had a little 3 kW diesel generators and a single sideband radio where you'd call in to Luang Prabang or Ban Hui Sai. Usually, or Vientiane, if you're closer to Vientiane.
Yeah.
Just radio check, you know, everything's okay, you know, you're on the radio for 10, 15 minutes, or you're listening to other people talk and making the radio checks, and then shut it down. So we had electricity twice a day, maybe 15 minutes each time. The rest of the time, kerosene lanterns.
Yeah. Kerosene.
And supposedly, if you missed a radio check, or, you know, they were supposed to send an airplane over to check on you. I had a little kerosene stove that didn't work very well, and the thing that worked best was the kerosene refrigerator made by Electrolux. I don't know if you had those in the Philippines or not. But
it was a regular,
I don't know, maybe a 14 or 16 cubic foot refrigerator, you know, a freezer compartment, or a fridge compartment, and kerosene tank at the bottom, and they worked quite well. And, know, keep your, well, I didn't, you know, after the first trip up country with beer, you know, I found all the locals came over to drink the beer and it was gone in about 15 minutes. I didn't take any more beer up. I couldn't afford it. But one place at Mung Met, I had problems with the wind. Kept blowing the fire out, so I made a deal with a couple of the local kids that they kept checking when I was out. They kept the fire going. And what I would do is bring Kool-Aid up for them. And they'd make ice cubes and sell the ice cubes. Kool-Aid popsicles.
So they were little entrepreneurs.
Right. You know, capitalists are probably in Los Angeles and open a supermarket now.
Yeah. Chain of convenience stores, maybe. That's interesting. That's cool. That's fun. Yeah, no, I wouldn't have had any place to buy kerosene.
Ah, okay. Well, we didn't. There was kerosene available because the locals used the kerosene in their pressure lanterns, you know, like the Coleman gas lanterns, except these were kerosene lanterns, my brand usually. But you didn't really want to buy kerosene if you could help it, so you'd talk to an Air America or Continental guy and bum a 55-gallon drum of JP1.
Well, see, I didn't have any Air America guys flying around. You know? And even to get a can yay big.
Right.
I'd have to bring it up on a weapons carrier or a logging truck along with my other stuff, and there were other priorities.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, like up in Hong Kong, Singapore, there was a problem getting the mail, and there was one Continental pilot who was just a super, super good guy, Al Adolf. He ended up getting killed and was later flying a B-17 fire bomber out of Los Angeles, and they got caught, you know, couldn't get out of a canyon, flew into the head wall. But anyway, Al, when he was flying up country, he'd, suddenly stop in at the IVS office, you know, the day before, any mail for those guys up country, and he'd put it in a bag and, you know.
Just do it.
Yeah, and he'd fly up, and if he could, if there wasn't any ground fog, you know, he'd come in and land, you know, at the taxpayer's expense, drop the mail off, and if there was ground fog, you know, we'd hear him, we'd talk to him, and let him know when he was overhead, and he'd just throw it out the window, and
he just watched through the clouds.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, put a streamer on it.
Yeah, something's falling. There it is. Okay. This really did work out for, it fulfilled all that adventure quotient that wanted.
Right. So, no, and then I kind of continued it, too, for a couple of years in USAID. You know, after 68, when I hired on USAID Refugee Relief, I did, other than the first 4 months in Vientiane, the next, up through June of 70, was upcountry in the north again, Luang Prabang, and Sam Tong, Luang Prabang, and over at Ban Hui Sai, and traveling all over the north. And, you know, with the airplanes and the refugees and the war going on.
Yeah, that reminds me. I asked you before about Pop Yule, and you said a few things, and one of the things you said was that he was the necessary man at that time.
Right.
I think he used the word necessary, I think. Yeah. But what was he like as a person?
Very personable guy.
Okay, you really could get to like him.
I
heard his language is pretty salty.
Well, I was going to say it was no great intellectual giant, but I'm not sure if that's a proper term. But he was a very, very intelligent man.
Yeah. There are different kinds of smarts.
There is. And he wasn't well educated, enlisted guy during World War II.
He was a farmer.
Yeah, the old Indiana farmer, and
right.
His wife died, and
uh-huh.
went off to IBS, and, he was hard-spoken. There's a videotape, an interview done with him by either CBS or NBC about 1965.
Didn't know this.
Oh, I've got it. I'll see if I can make a copy of it and mail it to you one way or another.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know that he had been interviewed.
It was not Edward R. Murrow. It was somebody who's, one of the major, reporters is dead, long dead now. But
a name that would be recognizable.
Yeah, yeah. Right. It's black and white. So
of course,
early on. And,
yeah.
But anyway, and he speaks straight in that movie, just like an Indiana farmer, very serious guy. And when I want somebody to come and work for me, I want an agriculturalist with expert who's got shit on his feet, on his boots, and not a PhD.
Yeah. That's what I'd want too.
Yeah, Pop. He didn't do it to me, but he was also known. I guess I've heard other people that he had done it to. And when you first went up to work for him, they, maybe give you a radio, maybe not. They'd take you out in the field. One of the upcountry sites, one of the real short, 600-foot, 800-foot airports, and drop you off, and then forget to pick you up, for 2 or 3 days.
And see how you do.
Yeah, see how you do.
Yeah,
you survive
yeah.
with the language problems, with the Hmong, and with the war going on, and the insecurity, et cetera,
yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, maybe I was too smart for that.
Maybe he saw he didn't have to do that with you.
Right.
Well, it's a good test.
Right.
I mean, if 2 days is not enough since you're going to get really, in any bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're freaking out, well,
right.
I don't want to,
Time to get another guy.
Yeah, so. I don't want to waste my time with you. Yeah.
Right. Oh. I had a real soft heart. There was a guy who I think still may be with the U.S. government now. He's a State Department guy.
Mm-hmm.
I won't mention his name because it's not necessary here, but this was spring of 69. And the embassy, he was the first tour embassy, I think, and I think they didn't like him very much, and they wanted to get rid of him. So they needed a bad efficiency report to do that. And they sent him up to Pop.
Figuring that he'll give him...
Right. And, Pop sent him out to Zingdat, I think it was, Site 26 for, one or two nights. And this guy hadn't taken a jacket with him, and it was, February or March, and it was cold.
Mm-hmm.
And he came back eaten by mosquitoes and... shivering and just smiling and laughing. Boy, it's a great place, blah, blah, blah. He seemed to screw up everything he did. There was rats in the warehouse, the rice warehouse. So he put some cats in the rice warehouse. And then the cats weren't very efficient. And, they were getting fat. And, Pop was asking, what happened? Well, he said, I feel sorry for the cats. So he's feeding the cats, buying cat food down the commissary. And so that's no good. So the next thing he did to get rid of the rats, he put some snakes in the warehouse, what I heard. And then the locals wouldn't go in the warehouse to get the rice.
Right.
And that didn't work. So.
Yeah.
But he ended up doing okay, and, staying on the State Department. And he switched to some other U.S. government agency.
Uh-huh.
So, soft heart. They, I don't know, maybe State pissed Pop off, and they want to dump the guy, and he's salvageable.
And even if Pop didn't think he was salvageable, he knew that they wanted Pop to give him the bad recommend, so just to get back at State, give him a good recommend.
Right.
Yeah. Two can play at the game.
Right.
Yeah.
Pop was able to get along with the Hmong leadership, Bong Pao and all that.
Very well, yeah.
The USAID leadership listened to him. The CIA leadership listened to him for years and years.
Was Pop ever CIA?
Oh, no.
He never...
No.
I thought not.
No.
Yeah.
No, it's like when I went on back home for Christmas, 68, 6 months after I'd been out of USAID, some friends of my parents, they were over, we just talked about Laos, et cetera, et cetera. They said, come on, tell me you're really CIA. Oh no, I was over in Laos, you know, with IVS, you know, $240 a month. Hey, come on, you were first lieutenant in the army, and you know all that. And
oh, now they would assume that.
You're making $340 when you got out of the army. You say you went to work for $240 a month, you know, forget it. Come on. I got out pissing me off. If I was getting paid CIA wages, I wouldn't mind it.
But I'm not going to tell you something that I'm not for a lousy $40 a month.
Right. You know, as far as I know, there was never anybody, you know, but infiltrated into IVS. There's only one guy I know who was IVS and then, you know, later went to work for CIA. But,
Well, Nuttall?
Huh?
Dave Nuttall?
No. Maybe there's two of them. So.
Yeah, he was, actually he was IVS Vietnam early on.
Yeah, right.
So he would have been into IVS Vietnam just a little bit ahead of Luce. So going quite far back.
Right.
You know, 59, 60, something like that.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he's one I knew. And then there was a guy, interviewed him up in the Twin Cities area.
Want to go pause? I'll mention his name.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I'll just pause. All right, we're back on.
I just think of the CIA models. So read some of the books or you read more of the articles and you think there's, you know, hordes and hordes of CIA wandering all over Laos. And in 69, when I worked up in Samtong area in Long Chang, the big CIA base, there was maybe, you know, right next door, 10 minutes flight away, 45-minute drive, there was, I don't know, 10 guys living there or something like that. And, and up country, there was only, in the north where I worked, only two guys, you know, covering, you know, quite a bit large area. Later, maybe 71, 72, and things, you know, they kind of closed down in 73, or early 73 with the ceasefires. You know, there are more people, there are, you know, raging wars and big battles with the North Vietnamese going on the Long Chang.
Right.
But I'd still guess there were less than 50 people, you know, during the daytime up there. A lot of them, you know, some were admin, there were air ops people, and, you know, advising on loading bombs and things of this sort, you know, ammo drops and the like. But, you know, not 500 of them all over the country.
No, that was...
Yeah, it makes a better story if you think everybody was infiltrated by CIA. But
yeah, I know. I mean, we had the same sort of thing in Peace Corps, too, where everyone's... Well, of course, all the Filipinos would say, oh, but you are CIA.
Right.
Yeah, right. What the hell am I doing here?
Yeah.
You know?
pay me the same, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like this is important enough.
Well,
then they would realize, and they'd just laugh and things like that. But, you know, but there's the story out there that so-and-so, know. And I think there was one person in Manila that we were advised not to talk to.
Yeah.
You know, but he was an older guy and had an office and, you know, expat American guy who'd been around for a long time. And we just knew that he was a little suspect and nobody knew for sure. And he always wanted to talk to people and find out stuff, what's going on.
Right.
So, you know.
Sometime spring of 67 when we work at Nambak, you know, and shuttling up there in the daytime, and you know, come back in the evening, you know, in the Air America or Continental or whatever was flying that day, and the CIA had a little, they had their office downtown along the bottom, and they had a little air ops shack out at the airport, and with, you know, wood with, you know, tin sides and, you know, the roofing tin on the roof and the like, and I know we had got the word that some reporters were coming up that day, and I got kind of a bug up my ass about something or other, and I went out early that morning with, you know, some paint and the like, and wrote, you know, Christians in Action on the side of their shack with the initial letters in big red or whatever with smaller letters, and got on my airplane and went up country, and, you know, a couple hours later, you know, comes through there where the pilots were, said, hey, they want you back in Luang Prabang, and
I bet so.
I thought it wasn't a good idea to go back to the LP right at that time, so I waited a while, you know, evening time to go back, I went back, and I was roundly chewed out for that. You know, they didn't see the humor in it, because, you know, the reporters were coming, and they didn't have time to paint over, no paint or whatever, so they had ripped the tin off the side of the shack in that particular area. But we still got along fine.
Playing with spooks, huh?
Right.
That's fun. God, it's... This is sort of crazy black humor that people who hadn't been through this would not really quite get. Oh, God. Well, you were actually pretty lucky, I think. You avoided any bad situations.
Yeah, well, I, you know, got shot at several times, you know, never got hit, you know, myself.
In what sort of circumstances were you get, where did you get shot at? You mean just in a general attack on
well, yeah, not individually. Right.
Yes,
yeah.
Okay, all
you know,
right.
Flying along in an airplane, and you know, pick up a few holes. And
right, which would be just at the airplane because it's up there.
Oh, yeah. Any airplane, you know, there's obviously, from the PL viewpoint, the bad guys.
Yeah, no PL Air Force.
Right.
Yeah.
And only the one ground attack, but it was attacking the valley, you know, and the army there. And,
yeah, and you were just there.
I happened to be living there. And, yeah, there was... Oh, there was one other attack where there were. We had a nice, a big tent. You know, I forget the 40-foot, 30-foot long. You know, a U.S. Army tent. Roll up the sides and let the breeze come through. And had the Army, you know, just GI cots on it, a sleeping bag, and you know, had a little refrigerator in the like the kerosene refrigerator, cook stove. And one night, I wasn't staying there, and you know, came up the next morning, and again, it wasn't a personal thing. But they had had a small raid on the camp and tried to blow up the ammo dump and the fuel dump, which was between my tent and the ammo, right on the runway is where my tent was, and the ammo and the fuel dump in the local army camp. And my tent had a bunch of holes in it, and also the GI cot, the wood rail, the horizontal rail had a bunch of holes in it. Had to
Ooh.
That away. So that
good was, thing you weren't in that cot.
No premonitions or anything. I just wanted to go down to walk along the hoop and holler, I guess, that night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Well, a good night to hoop and holler.
Right.
Jeez, yeah, compared to being staying behind.
Right.
Yeah, that's why I think I said lucky.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was a big measure of luck.
Well,
I mean, not being in the plane with Klisch and the others who died. That was luck.
Yeah, there's, you know, sort of decision points that come by, and, you know, that wasn't a decision. That was just luck, the circumstances, or fate, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's how I got out here in the Army, and fall of 63, when we got to Fort Belvoir for training, Engineer Officer's Basic Course, and I was assigned for 2 years to Fort Devens, Massachusetts, and that didn't sound like very much fun. And, you know, somebody came down from personnel at the Pentagon and said, hey, you're all second lieutenants, you can, you know, you're all basically the same, you know, specialty code. Anybody wants to swap orders, let us know.
Oh, yeah.
So I put my name on the board. Anybody want to go to Fort Devens? And, you know, several people, you know, made offers that I didn't like, and one guy, the day before the deadline, came running up and said, hey, you're Tom Savilla, looking for you. You know, I'm from 50 miles from Fort Devens. My wife is 7 months pregnant.
Oh, he's got to go there.
Yeah. Oh, God, I sympathize. You know, where are you going? Well, Karat, Thailand. And, well, I knew where Thailand was. No idea where Karat is. But,
doesn't matter.
But given the timing, you know.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Sounds good. And that was, you know, what, 36 years later, here I still are.
Yeah. And still enjoying it.
Yeah, and I had a good time, you know, going back to get the water, you know, chatting with the staff there in the, restaurant. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, there's several Northeasterners there, you know, speak, you know, they were surprised, you know, why do you speak Lao? So, speaking Lao in Bangkok is often more fun than speaking Thai.
Catches them by surprise, does it?
Well, there's, I don't know, thousands or tens of thousands of American foreigners, Farangs, who speak Thai. And there aren't a whole lot that speak
anything else,
Lao or Northeastern, Thai. So,
You
know, sometimes it's more fun.
Oh, yeah, really snap them up to attention. Right. Holy cow.
Yeah,
I've got to go back to that that washroom. So
okay.
I'm going to switch this.
Yeah, okay, we're back on again.
And sort of heading down toward the home stretch, I guess. One thing that we've been asking people in the States, it's going to be an interesting question for you, because you've been here before and long after, whereas a lot of people in the States have their IVS experiences in discrete part of their life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from here to here, and then I went home.
Right.
You know. Or I might have stuck around a little while, but I'm home now, and I have been for the last 20 years or something. So they can look back and see things very clearly, whereas with you it might be kind of a interconnected sort of blur in some ways. But looking back, what did IVS do for you?
Well, one thing I think it helped me with, like, what tolerance. I think I I've never been a real angry person, but I think IBS, you know, sitting up there in the pucker brush, you know, not having a whole lot myself in upcountry Laos, and just seeing a lot of other folks that had somewhat less, and they got along, I got along fine with what I had. And they, you know, and then of course later I spent another, after IBS, spent another 7 years in Laos. And
right.
Saw more of the same, but you know, I think that helped a lot when I got to Sudan, Khartoum in 87, you know, many years later, you know, and Sudan is a real ratchet place to live. But yeah, hey, what's there to complain about? You know, the local people here have to live here all their life.
Yeah, right. You're only here for, what, 2 years?
For two years, right. So, you know, it's not so bad, you know. But,
could be worse. Living here permanently.
Yeah. Look at the positive side. I've always been one of those with, you know, the beer glass is half full. You know, it's not half empty.
Okay. Yeah. So reinforce that.
Right. I think IBS helped on that. And I, yeah, I look back at it as, you know, an enjoyable experience. You know, some people, I think, you know, didn't enjoy it so much. You know, they just counting down, when is their contract over? You know, we want to get out of here.
Yeah,
But then, you know, after I left IBS, I stayed on in Laos for 9 years till 75, and then I followed that with another 7 years in Thailand working on the refugee program here until 1983, and then went elsewhere, back to D.C. and Khartoum. Cairo, and then I came back in 1989. So that's
and Russia as well.
Well, Russia was after it was. Well, I was back here. I took you know 22 months out of here and went to Moscow.
Oh, okay.
So that was.
But I'm just getting the
an interlude, right?
Yeah, but certainly you're an international person.
Right. Well, I, you know, looking back, I graduated from college in '63, and I think in that period I've spent about 6 years in the U.S.
Uh huh.
And out of that, I spent 28 years in Thailand and Laos, maybe 29 years. So you know, I just know more folks, more people here. So,
yeah.
Whether they're Farangs, Americans, whatever, passing through, or some other nationalities passing through, or Thai, and a lot of, you know, some Lao pass through that I see now and then. And
yeah.
I still get up to Vientiane now and then. And,
oh, you do?
Yeah.
So yeah.
Easy to travel up there in spite of the bombing right now. And,
yeah, right.
I still have a couple Lao friends up there. And, haven't been to Wat Thabong since 1990, but would like to go again. Perhaps later this year.
And the government there, even though it's a Marxist government, is certainly more like a Lao Marxist than a.
Well, that's what I was saying earlier about problems with some of the quasi resistance. You know, and say, hey, it's long past the time when you should have had the resistance. Time to hang it up in 1990 is, you know, in the end, they say capitalism and the corruption wins out over communism every day. And Vietnam has gone from nothing to what, the second largest rice exporter in the world. You know, after Thailand, you know, surpassed the U.S.
And, as soon as they removed the controls.
Right. And, you know, Laos is still communist. You know, Cuba is communist. They're not very good communists, I think. China, you know, needs to feed their people.
Lousy communists.
But it's still communist.
Yeah.
The only real one going, which is failing, is North Korea. Only five countries left in the world. The old communist leadership dying off, and, you know, things will turn around.
Yeah. So you really see. Actually, I was a little bit mistaken, because you do see the IBS thing as a discrete part, you know.
Oh yeah, no, proud of having been IBS as opposed to Peace Corps. I probably wouldn't have joined the Peace Corps.
So, yeah.
You know, if that time I mentioned earlier, you know, and I just saw that note about IBS, you know, in Laos, down in Southern Oregon, that was fall of '63, December '63, and I could have signed up for Peace Corps at the same time.
You could have, that's right.
It didn't even dawn on me, and I don't know why, to sign up for Peace Corps. Maybe from the publicity that Peace Corps had, it was too, at the time, you know, too idealistic or whatever.
It was.
Yeah, 63, 64, didn't really turn me on. I wanted something more practical.
No, it was like singing songs around the campfire.
Yeah, right.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
Some of the people I was with in my training group, I'd slap them.
Right. Well.
And of course, to be honest, I was partially that too.
Right.
But perhaps everyone is at that age. But Whew. Yeah, it was more.
Right. So IVS seemed a little more, you know, down to earth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If I had taken the Peace Corps route, I would have had an extra 4% of my government retirement.
It's true.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's okay.
But that's all right. Yeah, well, then you would have also had more money in your pocket when you were a volunteer.
Quite a bit more, because they did not take the repatriation. Was mm-hmm. $75 a month? They didn't take that out. Plus, we had commissary. And and when I ran low, I'd, you know, buy a case of booze and, you know, market it to the local colonel. And at cost. never black market for profit. That I never approved of, but mm-hmm. I can survive through the next month or through the end of the month. And there's a Thai guy that worked in our commissary, and he still lives in Thailand here. You know, he was the guy who pulled the cards, you know, for overdue payments. And I was always overdue. But to what child? But he's a good guy, and I'm always overdue, but he knew I'd pay one day. So he did not report my overdue card to the boss, the American boss.
But, yeah, okay. So I was sort of blanking out for just a second there.
Right.
Maybe more than a second.
Now, you know, experience, you know, Army, IBS, then...
Then all that AID
time. You say Laos, and then...
...the disk and, you know, make it a part of a, you know, of a record.
Yeah, send it as a WAV file. It'll use up a whole CD.
Oh, no. A WAV file?
Well, those are the music you get, or you can, you know, send it as a voice.
Oh, gosh,
but,
no, please.
You know, large, large files.
No, I don't have my computer hooked up to speakers, because I know I just listen to music and stuff like that and not work, so I can listen to music in my radio at home.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Anyway, so thank you very much.
Okay, well, pleasure to be here.
Really thank you, because you had to, maybe you always get up early in the morning, I don't know, but...
Well, yeah, you had to drive. 5:45 this morning. I got to 5. So
okay, but you had to truck into town.
Right.
You're going to have to truck back out there. And
I've got a truck. You can't see it.
Okay, but probably it's not going to be as fast going back as it was coming in, because there will be more traffic now.
Hopefully I'll hit the expressway.
Hopefully you'll hit that wonderful new Thai expressway.
Right.
You know, and things will be a lot better. But still, it is going out of your way.
Right.
And I do appreciate that.
No problem.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Mac, pleasure meeting you. I will. Yeah, well, who knows? Maybe let me turn this off.
All right.
Bye.